A while back on this program, I spoke with inmates inside the Iowa State Penitentiary, offenders serving life sentences for violent crimes. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, A Victim's Perspective, a conversation with Jonna Williams of Waterloo. In 1994, when she was just 13 years old, she was kidnapped and raped.
Once you survive a violent crime, it never, never goes away. It's something you learn to live with. It's not something you can ever get over, so to speak.
Also joining us, Blackhawk County Prosecutor Tom Ferguson, who was on that case, and Mary Roach, Director of Victim Programs with the Iowa Department of Corrections. First, a look at the hour's news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A few weeks ago here on River to River, we brought you two programs from inside the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison. I spoke with offenders in their cells, offenders who were convicted of murder and are serving life sentences. And we were glad to hear from many listeners about those shows. One person in particular who got in touch with me was the victim of an offender now serving time at the Iowa State Penitentiary. So today, we present her perspective as a victim of a violent crime. In 1994, at the age of 13, Jonna Williams was kidnapped and raped in Waterloo. A few days ago, she came into our studio to talk about the crime, the trial, how it's changed her life, and to advocate for victims of crime. And a note before we get started that some of the content today is difficult to listen to and may not be appropriate for everyone. Jonna Williams, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much for having me.
We want to thank you for contacting us and coming into our studio to share your story. The purpose of this hour is to understand the victim's perspective in violent crime, and in this case, to understand your specific story as a victim. And I'd like to have you start out by telling us what happened that day and to make sure you know, to have you provide what you feel is enough detail that we non-victims of violent crime have some understanding, some grasp of the impact that such a crime can have on a life, on your life. Can you tell us what happened on that day, July 4th, 1994?
Sure. Well, I had decided to meet a friend for ice cream. It was obviously July, so a little bit warm outside. And I got on my bike and with parents' permission and rode through Waterloo. I was on my way to the library to meet a friend, and I was approached by a man who had asked me for directions, which didn't seem out of the ordinary. It was the middle of the afternoon. It was on Independence Avenue, so a fairly well-traveled street in Waterloo. He was obviously older than I was and a bit larger than I was, and he said, well, you know, I can't hear you, and so I repeated the directions that I had given him, and he became a bit violent and grabbed me off of my bike, and he took me to a secluded area and assaulted me. And during this entire time, he continued to make threats that he was going to kill me. And there's a moment in that time where I thought, from beginning to talking to him, I thought, oh, this is not good. And it was a transformational moment where I thought, okay, this is really serious. This is really, really a problem. This is stranger danger. This is not okay. And that was just a shift, a perspective shifting moment where I thought, okay, what do I do now? How do I get out of this?
Mm-hmm. What was that moment? Was the moment he lured you closer to him by acting like he hadn't heard what you said when he asked for directions? The moment that you had this shift where you knew you were in danger was when he grabbed you off your bike?
Yes, yes. Once he actually touched me, then I thought, okay, this is serious. He grabbed me off of my bike, and again, he was much larger than I was, and took me up a hill to a secluded area next to railroad tracks, and he was very threatening. And
what did he say, may I ask?
Sure. He said, don't cry, don't scream, don't say anything, or I'm going to snap your neck and kill you. And that was his key phrase throughout the entire attack is I'm going to snap your neck and kill you. And being larger than I was, that seemed pretty reasonable to believe that he was going to do that.
Mm-hmm. And I understand from court documents that he had you in a hold around your neck that would make you not doubt that.
Yes, yes. Much like a chiropractor would when a chiropractor is planning to adjust you. It was similar to that, yes.
Mm-hmm. So he dragged you up the hill. You didn't feel that you could scream?
You know, I didn't. I was just finishing seventh grade and was not a very athletic seventh grader. And so I was pretty well aware that for me to take off and run wasn't going to be in my best interest. And it seemed like my brain just kicked into survival mode, what to do from here on out, mm-hmm. Just to survive. And so I thought, okay, well, I can't run because he's bigger than me, and he's you know, 6'2". He's gonna be able to run a lot faster than I am. And traffic never stopped. Before he took me up the hill, he kept me under the railroad tracks for a short time, and traffic didn't stop. And that traffic not stopping, no one stopping, seeing a larger man obviously apprehending a child, gave me less hope that it was beneficial to run out into traffic and try and flag down a car.
Mm-hmm.
And so also running through my head is, if a person walking down the street is going to do this to me, am I going to be in that much greater danger if I get in the car with someone?
I understand he assaulted you closer to the road, and then also after he dragged you some yards away up into a woodsy area?
He did, yes.
What were you saying to him? He was threatening you to snap your neck. What were you saying to him?
You know, I said, I don't have any money, but you can take my bike. Just please don't hurt me. Please let me go.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't really privy to that idea at all. At times he would say, I'm not going to hurt you. And other times he would say, I'm going to kill you. But for the most part, he stuck to his plan. His plan was to kill me. And that was pretty clear.
You said you were in survival mode, understandably. What does that mean when you look at this perpetrator? Survival mode means what? Trying to figure out why he's doing what he's doing?
That came about later in the attack. Initially, I just thought, okay, we're going to plan out every move. I'm going to plan every move I make, everything I say. And it's almost like time just slowed down a little bit. And I took in details about what he looked like, what he said. I tried to recall everything about him that I could.
Can you share some of those details?
Sure. I noticed he wasn't wearing shoes, and I thought that was rather strange. I noticed that he had very long hair, and there were just unusual things, like he had the collar of his shirt was cut off, which just seemed very, very odd.
Later in his defense, I believe he talked about being high on drugs. Was that evident?
In retrospect, it was. But I was, you know, I was 13. My friends and I were still concerned about sleepovers and Nickelodeon and New Kids on the Block. And so he did at one point say, my friends got me high off drugs. But that wasn't evident to me at that time.
Mm-hmm. He assaulted you down closer to the road, dragged you up into a more secluded area.
Yes.
And assaulted you again. How long did he hold you up there?
You know, I would say approximately just under an hour. Just under an hour. And later, looking back, I've looked at court documents since then and thought to myself, God, that seemed like 3 hours, 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I know it wasn't, but it seemed like a lifetime.
Were you praying?
You know, I did. I'm not a religious person, and nor is my family, but it was a last-ditch effort that I thought, well, you know, I've heard people do this, so I guess I'm going to pull out whatever I can to try and survive this. And so I did. I did pray, and he asked me what I was doing, and I said, you know, I'm praying to God so you don't kill me. I had hoped that would resonate with him in some way. I don't think it did.
Tell us how you finally got away, or how he finally left you.
He did leave me, which I thought was odd. After the assault ended, he said, all right, I want you to count to 1,000 and stay here, and I'm going to go across the street and watch you. And you're going to get on your bike and you're going to go home. And if you cry or scream in the middle of the street, I'm going to hunt you down right there and kill you right there in the street. And follow, you know, before this, he had said, I'm going to come back and kill your family anyway. He had made me tell him where I live and who my parents were and my address and things like that. And there were a lot of children in the neighborhood. It, you know, I had two little girls younger than me that lived next door to me. And I couldn't at that moment come up with a fake address. And I thought if I did give him a fake address and he knew, there was signing my death sentence right there.
He was very concerned that you would describe him, right, and ask you about that.
He was. He asked me, what do I look like? And I started thinking, oh, my God, just if you just lie to him and say, you know, you're really short when you're really tall. If I gave him a fake description, he would believe that I was going to, first of all, not tell anyone, and second of all, lie about it if I did. So he said, am I tall? And I said, no. And he said, am I white? And I said, no, you're black. And he said, do I have long hair? And I said, no, you have short hair.
You are counting. He leaves.
Correct.
You're counting to 1,000. Do you remember how far you got in that count to 1,000?
Oh, probably 900. I'm really not sure how, but probably 900. And then I walked down the hill and got on my bike and went home.
You went home, and I believe no one was there. Your parents were gone.
They were visiting relatives in Cedar Rapids. Before I had left, my mom had called and said, what are you doing? Where are you going? Here's what time we're going to be home. And I had explained to her what I was doing and where I was going, who I was going to be with, when mm-hmm. I would be back. And when I returned home, there was no one there.
So what did you do?
I called the friend that I was supposed to meet and spoke with his dad and explained to him what happened. And he came and picked me up and took me to his house because I didn't want to call the police at that point. I think because I thought, oh, my God, I don't want to get in the car with a police officer and my mom's not here.
Your parents arrived when?
After I spent some time at my friend's house with his parents, they brought me back, and my parents were back at their house around 6:30, I think.
Was it hard to tell them? They learned of it before they came into the room with you, or did you tell them right when they came in?
I went into the house immediately, and my friend's parents told my parents, and my mom called the police, and she and I went to the hospital and met with a police officer there and did a rape kit.
Jonna Williams is my guest. She's the victim of a 1994 kidnapping and rape, relaying her story today so that we can juxtapose our view of offenders from a few weeks ago. We were in Fort Madison at the Iowa State Penitentiary, getting the offender's perspective, juxtapose that with victims. Jonna Williams, they found the perpetrator fairly quickly, didn't they?
They actually found him 2 days later at a house of a friend or a relative. I'm not quite sure in whose house it was. I don't believe it was his residence. He was hiding in a closet. And one of the distinct features about him that I noticed during the attack is that he smelled like body odor. And it was a very overwhelming stench. And one of the search warrants that the police served was on the residence that he was in, and they were able to find him hiding in a closet based on the smell of him.
Mm-hmm. At one point, you had to identify this man in a photo lineup. What do you remember about that?
Wow, it was monumental. I think there are times in life when we have involuntary reactions to things, and I had not had many of those being a young person, and so his photo was already on record at the police department as he was a repeat sex offender. This was his second crime, and it was there. And so I don't remember which number he was, but he was shown to me in a photo lineup by an investigator, and I just kind of freaked out and fell apart. It was absolutely shocking. Absolutely shocking.
The offender, Dale Dean Veers, was apprehended, charged, and later convicted of kidnapping in the first degree and sexual abuse in the second degree, awaiting the trial. Tell us about those first weeks after the crime, the reaction of your family, the support you received, and the reaction of the other kids in your neighborhood. You're 13 years old at this time.
It was a bit crazy. Family dynamics obviously changed a great deal, and my parents did an exceptional job of maintaining some normalcy in the household. My mom immediately became, I guess, almost a rehab therapist for me, and she encouraged me to do regular everyday things, to continue to spend time with friends, to go to the pool and to the mall, and to learn how to leave the house again. I did not want to leave the house at all, and it was evident within probably a few weeks to my parents that we needed to relocate, we needed to move, and they started that process very quickly, and found a house for us across town. And the next few weeks were pretty pretty stressful. I talked with therapists and with the county attorney's office and with different, certainly doctors at that time. I had to do some extensive HIV testing. At that time, it wasn't as advanced as it is now. And so I went back every few weeks and was tested for HIV. And there were just a lot of logistical things, talking with the police department, talking with therapists and investigators and things like that.
Why tell your story now? Why share it with Iowa Public Radio listeners?
Recently, I've heard a lot of coverage on different aspects of criminals and of like the recent story that you did on the Department of Corrections and the new prison. I just heard another story recently on some other things happening with overcrowding in prisons and how to deal with that and shortening sentences for offenders. And throughout all of that, it seems like there is a lack of acknowledgement about the victims, their families, and what they're going through and what aftermath they have to deal with. Once you survive a violent crime, it has happened to you and it stays with you forever. And it never, never goes away. It's something you learn to live with, mm-hmm. but it's not something you can ever get over, so to speak. And I just – something that I try and adhere to is to know your impact. And something that really sticks with me is for my offender, he's still alive. He's in jail. And I want him to know his impact. Not in a way that I'm angry or bitter about what happened, but he still has the rest of his life that he could do good things with. And other offenders that are in jail now, they still have time to do some restorative justice work and to change and to know the impact that they have on other people.
Jonna, you got in touch with us because, as you said, you heard about our two-part program visiting the Iowa State Penitentiary, where I interviewed both staff and inmates, several inmates serving life sentences. You got in touch with me because you had some concerns. Would you share those concerns?
I did. Immediately after I heard the advertisement, I heard you say that you'd be interviewing lifers at the Iowa State Penitentiary, and in the brief advertisement, there wasn't a lot of explanation on that, and it just stopped me. It just stopped everything I was doing at that moment, and the rest of my night, all I could think was, oh my God, who are they going to interview? Is it my offender? Whose offender is it? What are they going to talk about? What are they going to say? What if my mom hears this? Have the victims of those crimes been notified? What do their families think?
Would you mind sharing any parts of the interviews with the offenders at the Iowa State Penitentiary that you remember most that stick out in your mind?
Sure. One of them was where one of the offenders said, you had asked him, did he have time to think about the reason that he was in prison for the rest of his life? And he said, well, I try not to cry over spilled milk. And to me, that was a stunning comment. because all I could think was, that's someone's child. That was someone's relative. That was someone's loved one that you referred to as spilled milk. That was the end of their life. And it was stunning. It was stunning. Another one was when the offenders talked about how they had access to medical care and to housing and meals and leisure activities, things like a workout facility, and that was how they spent their time. And it just brought me back to think, oh my gosh, I have to work, and I have to go to work and get health insurance. I don't just get health insurance because I survive violent crime. I have to pay for my gym membership, which may sound like a petty thing, but that's one of the great ways that I cope with surviving violent crime and being a productive member of society. Is I work out, and it just brought me back to all the things that are afforded to offenders that victims often don't get.
Jonna Williams is with us. She's the victim of a 1994 kidnapping and rape when she was 13 years old in Waterloo. And joining us now, in addition to Jonna, in our studio, Tom Ferguson. He's a Blackhawk County prosecutor. Tom Ferguson, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Tom, you prosecuted this case back in 1994, correct?
Yes, it started in 1994, and we finished up actually with the trial in 1995.
Take us through the trial. What were your first thoughts and concerns about prosecuting this case, and also, of course, because it involved a minor?
I think the major issue that I had with the case was sitting down with Jonna and having Jonna be vocal about what had happened to her. It took us many, many, many visits before Jonna could sit down with me and talk to me about what had happened. That was a major hurdle that we had to climb, and I understood that was going to be an issue. So when we first started meeting, I would visit with Jonna, and we'd have these long discussions about her riding horses and getting to know her and her getting to know me and become a little bit more comfortable with me, because the way our system is set up, Jonna was going to have to walk into a courtroom, sit there in front of a number of strangers on a jury box, and tell everybody very intimate details about this horrible event.
Blackhawk County Prosecutor Tom Ferguson. He prosecuted the 1994 case of Jonna Williams. And when we come back after a short break, Jonna will tell us the challenges of sitting in that courtroom as a 13-year-old to face and identify the man who kidnapped and raped her. We'll also hear from Mary Roach, Director of Victim Programs with the Iowa Department of Corrections. I'm Ben Kiefer. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, the perspective of a victim of violent crime. In 1994, at the age of 13, Jonna Williams of Waterloo was kidnapped and raped. A few days ago, she came into our studio to talk about the crime, the trial, how it's changed her life, and to advocate for victims of crime. She was joined by the prosecutor in the case, Tom Ferguson. And we pick up the story in preparing for the trial. Tom Ferguson, as prosecutor, what can you say about how strong this case was against Dale Dean Veers?
Well, I think it was a very strong case in several aspects. I mean, Jonna was very articulate in describing Mr. Veers when she related that information to police. She was right on between his you know, height and his weight, his age, his hair, the type of clothes he was wearing, fact that he had, you know, facial features like a long face, you know, the clothing, all of that was very, very detailed. And obviously, John indicated during that point in time, she made conscious effort to note those things, and she obviously relayed those things and her positive identification of him from the photo lineup as well as in court. But beyond all of that, there was some physical evidence that was all consistent with Mr. Veers being the perpetrator. You have to think this was back in 1994, early 1995. We're just at the advent of DNA, and it was starting to progress. Obviously, it had not progressed to the level it has to today, but we had to send some of this testing off from the DCI lab to the FBI lab. And although all the tests were not as conclusive or definite as they are today, they were all consistent with Mr. Veers being the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. Coupled that with the fact that he was in the area, was staying or been at a house in the 500 block of Independence earlier that day, some of the things he had told Jana, namely he was using drugs, those types of factors, the fact that we found clothing similar to what Jana had described at the residence where he was ultimately located at, all of those things just piled on top of one another, which made it a convincing case.
Jana, I have to believe that taking the stand facing Mr. Veers was the most challenging part of that trial. What do you remember most about taking the stand and looking in his eyes? Or did you?
You know, I don't think I did. I obviously had to look at him and point him out and identify him as the person who assaulted me. That which is required when you take the stand. I think that certainly the time spent with Tom, going over the story, building a relationship where we could have a conversation. I remember talking. It was almost like, okay, I was in the courtroom with this judge and this jury and all these people and the other attorneys and the offender, but Tom and I were having a conversation, and I tried to focus on him and what we were talking about, what we had to do, and that was it.
Did you notice any reaction in the courtroom from Mr. Veers or others?
I did not. I did not. Not at all. I don't recall anything out of the ordinary, except for focusing on, I'm going to have this conversation with Tom. We've had this conversation before. We're going to have it again, just like we've been doing.
The perpetrator, Dale Dean Veers, was convicted, sent to serve his sentence at the Iowa State Penitentiary, where he is to this day. Jana, as a victim, how much relief did you have? Did that bring you, that conviction, the fact that he was found guilty, locked up, where he couldn't harm you or anybody else, did that bring you relief?
It did. It did. I had very much a great deal of concern for my family. I didn't want them to have to be exposed to him and other children, certainly. I think in the long term, I have more relief now about it than I did then. Mm-hmm. Then I think my brain was still pretty foggy and I was still trying to deal with life on life's terms and with what had just happened. And so now being in my 30s, I think, oh, thank God he's not out and he has no chance of being out, because if he was, I don't know how I would cope with that.
So tell us, how has that changed you, being the victim of a rape and kidnapping, changed you? Do you, for instance, ever ponder what sort of person Jana Williams might have been had this not happened?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that now, but I have. I feel like in some sense it slowed my life down a great deal. I feel like I could be a lot farther in life. At times, I think that it has changed. It certainly changed everything in my life. It's changed everything from relationships to healthcare choices to living situations to how I choose to protect myself, how I handle myself in public. It has absolutely changed everything.
You are working as a social worker, I understand.
I am, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did that crime have an influence on that decision, that career path?
I think in retrospect, it probably did. I didn't knowingly go out and choose that career and think this is what I'm going to do because I survived violent crime. I think surviving violent crime has given me a mindset that I want to help other people and prevent unnecessary suffering. And in that, my career has just taken that turn.
Mm-hmm. Jonna, also joining us in the studio, Mary Roach, Director of Victims Programs with the Iowa Department of Corrections. Mary Roach, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. I understand you've known Jonna for many years. What are your thoughts on this case as you hear her retell this story, Tom Ferguson in this conversation as well, and your thoughts on what she's had to deal with since 1994?
I have always been amazed by Jonna's strength of character and inspired every time I've heard her speak and share her experience and how she has been on this path of healing and recovery.
Tell us about the services that the Department of Corrections here in Iowa offers victims of violent crimes.
Sure. One of the basic services for all crime victims is the right to register and be notified of various things that are happening with a case. And that starts very early on. Victims can register with the county attorney's office in the county where the case is being prosecuted. And that's kind of the place where victims get hooked up into the criminal justice system all the way through to sentencing, incarceration, parole, etc.
Mm-hmm. Jonna, were you happy with the Crime Victim Assistance Program?
I didn't have as much interaction with the program as maybe my family did. I was 13, and so I didn't think about things like the bill that would come from the hospital for the rape kit. That was something my parents had to deal with. I didn't think about the cost of replacing my clothing or things like that. So looking back and years later, talking with my mom about it, yes, I think we were satisfied with the services. And we were always kept up to date on the appeal process, what was happening with the offender. We knew exactly when he was transferred from Blackhawk County Jail to Oakdale to Fort Madison. We were made well aware of when that was happening. And there was always someone to answer the phone. I remember a couple of years ago, I just wanted to know what Dale's life was like. It just stuck with me that I needed to know, what was he doing? Was he sitting around watching cable all the time?
Mm-hmm.
So I called the Department of Corrections down to Mary's office, and I spoke with some folks down there, and they were quick to recognize that this was important, and they got me the information I needed.
In fact, you, I understand, have sought to meet Dale, the man who raped and kidnapped you. Why?
Well, because it's so important to me that something good comes from this. And I've done a lot of healing. I've done a lot of therapy and of getting through how to deal with this situation and how to live with it in my life. And to me, I want to write this book and to communicate to people that being a victim of violent crime is everlasting in your life. And I'd like to talk to Dale and just ask him, what happened to you in your life that led you to make the decisions that you made? How has that changed you? What do you think now? If it were up to me, I think Dale should be doing work for victims in prison. I'd like him to do something positive with his life.
What would you hear that would be good for you to hear?
Best case scenario would be to hear that he is doing something valuable that will help other offenders or help other victims, help offenders recognize what they have done and the impact that they have had, that their actions have had on other people, and helping them find a way to do some kind of restorative justice work and do something valuable to give back to the community because he still has a valuable life.
Mm-hmm. Let's say he did turn his life around. He did do the things you just mentioned. He was rehabilitated. Could you, Jonna, ever support his release?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I was not his first victim. And I'm sure there weren't only two of us. While he may be able to do that in his life, he is not a safe person for the community.
What has his reaction been to your request for a victim-offender dialogue?
He has not wanted to meet with me. I think Mary could probably speak a little bit more about that as she's spoken with him directly. Mm-hmm.
So this went through you, Mary Roach, as Director of Victims Programs. Does Iowa have an official victim-offender dialogue program?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we do. It started in the early 1990s. And one thing I want to emphasize is that victim-offender dialogue is not for every crime victim. So, but when you have someone like Jonna who is determined and has specific reasons for meeting directly with an offender, we want to make sure that that service is available.
Mm-hmm. What would be the reasons that you would see that would be compelling for you? You would say it's not for every victim. What victims are it for? What are they seeking? What are the legitimate reasons for meeting an offender?
Oftentimes it's similar to Jonna, specific questions that they've never gotten answers to. You know, certain things come out in a trial, but a lot of things are left for victims to wonder and question. One of the big ones is, why did this person do this to me? And that often does not get answered in a court trial. So having questions answered is a big motivator. For other people, in cases in particular where someone may eventually be released back into the community, there's sometimes a desire to make a connection with them to find out, how are they doing? What have they done? Do they still pose a risk? For other victims, they want to be able to sit down face-to-face and tell this person directly what they did. Again, as a criminal justice system, we often protect the offender from fully realizing what they did to another person. And it isn't until they actually hear from crime victims what the impact on their life has been that it may begin to dawn on them.
Mary Roach, are offenders in any way obligated to meet with their victims?
No. Our victim-offender dialogue program, one of the requirements is that it is voluntary for both the victim and the offender. And our program is what we consider a victim-centered program, meaning we only accept referrals from victims. It would be inappropriate for an offender to make a request, and then I go seek out a crime victim to say, you know, your offender would like to meet with you. I think that would not be a good idea.
What about a request from a victim's relative, say, Jonna's mother or father, seeking such a meeting?
Yes, yes.
That does happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Mary Roach, Director of Victims Programs at the Iowa Department of Corrections, along with Jonna Williams, the victim of a 1994 kidnapping and rape. Let's talk about restitution. Are offenders required to pay it, Mary?
Yes, they are, and that comes from a court order that
the judge determines this.
Yes.
The amount.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In your case, Jonna, what was the restitution to be paid?
My offender had to pay $870, which was the cost of the rape kit, and that was paid to the Crime Victim Assistance Fund. Above and beyond that, he did not pay restitution.
That's it?
Correct.
That has to hurt.
You know, it does. It at the time it didn't, but now it does. Looking back at the financial implications that surviving a violent crime had on my family, absolutely.
Mary Roach, $800. Comment on that.
Back in 1994, I would imagine that would probably be a typical amount. A restitution has to reflect out-of-pocket expenses that someone has incurred as a result of a crime. So it's not meant to be, what's the word, Tom?
Punitive?
It's not like a negligence action where you can sue somebody for damages and a civil action for your loss of freedom, loss of liberty, loss of for your pain and suffering, those sorts of things. So it has to be pecuniary damages, which means out of pocket, which in this particular case, it obviously the doctor's exam, which crime victim assistance pays for as part of the sexual assault examination, and then he'll have to repay. It could be Jonna's clothing at the time, whatever dollars that cost for her clothing. Since that time, obviously, crime victim assistance and the whole victims' rights movement has evolved. It's probably not to where we'd all want it to be, mm-hmm. but it's changed a great deal during the nearly 29 years I've been an assistant and now a Blackhawk County attorney. So,
In what ways, specific ways, have you seen it evolve in nearly three decades?
Well, I think it's, when I first started prosecuting back in the early 1980s, today we have, registration for victims. We have victim impact statements where victims can get in the courtroom and make an impact statement to the court. The amount of damages that or assistance they can receive from crime victim assistance, whether it be through counseling services, whether it be through some loss of work to attend trials in homicide cases. In homicide cases, there's now $150,000 judgment that is leveled against the offender or defendant at the time of sentencing. It has evolved a great deal. More services are provided through for victims, whether it be at the local level through Department of Correctional Services, once the case is over in our office, or through the Department of Corrections. So it has evolved a great deal. We have Crime Victims Rights Week every year in April. And I think that it's very important that victims like Jonna and others share their stories. As Mary said, and as Jonna may have said as well, our system focuses a lot on offenders and defendants and their rights, but there's always another part to the story, and that story is often silent. And giving victims the opportunity to share their story, whether it be in the courtroom through a victim impact statement or through other processes, is vitally important for victims, and it's also for the public, that we make the public aware and reemphasize that with each one of these offenses, there's another part to the story many times you don't get to hear.
Mm-hmm. Jonna, do you feel in Iowa that the Department of Corrections has struck an appropriate balance in terms of the resources, the money, the programs devoted to help victims compared to those dedicated to help offenders?
I don't think so. Which is mainly due to funding. It's due to funding. There aren't a lot of victims who are going to stand up and say, "Hey, I need services. I need help. I need to learn how to be a productive member of society. I need to learn to re-enter into the community just like my offender did." There just aren't a lot of victims that are going to stand up and say that, because every time you do as a victim, you have to acknowledge that you have survived a violent crime. And so I think corrections has done a great job with offenders in making sure that that all efforts are placed on them not reoffending. But I think it's due to a lack of money, and there just aren't a lot of crime victims that want to get up and say, "Hey, I need help and I need assistance and I need to reenter into the community just like my offender did."
Mary Roach, do you agree? How do you see Jonna's criticism, if we can say that, of the DOC?
Victim services in general, over the past, 5-7 years, the budget crisis has impacted victim services on the local level as well as the state level. And when there's fewer dollars to be spent, as Jonna mentioned, it's not bringing victims together as a group to lobby or to be a strong voice in a legislative effort is difficult, because you're talking about a wide group of people.
Jonna, you're writing this book about your experience with the eye on the intent of helping explain the victim's perspective. Would you be open to having people, perhaps other victims, contact you?
Absolutely. If you know about this case, if it affected you in your life, in the community, I would love to hear from you. Or if you're a victim and you just want to talk about it, I'm more than willing to talk. I can be found on Facebook, obviously. Also, I've got a Gmail account. It's JonnaRWilliams@gmail.com.
Jonna Williams, I want to thank you again very, very much for writing that email to me a few weeks ago and for coming forward and for telling your story, sharing your insights this hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Also, thanks to Tom Ferguson, Blackhawk County Prosecutor. Tom, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
And Mary Roach, Director of Victim Programs with the Iowa Department of Corrections. Mary, thank you.
I appreciated being here. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. In Cedar Falls, help from Tony Daner. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.